Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the third hour of the program, broadcasting live from Heidel House in Green Lake, Wisconsin, day three of our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour as part of the South Wisconsin District Pastors Conference of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We'll spend this last hour talking about the defense of life from beginning to end. Dr. Kevin Voss joins us. You can join us as well, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or 505-7850. You can also email us questions or comments in this last hour, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We've all heard about those wildfires. They are still, in some way, still causing havoc, and the need that they created, even after they're long gone, will continue for a long, long time. LCMS World Relief is concerned about that need and on the front lines. Find out more about what Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief is doing there and elsewhere in the world. Give them a call, 1-888-930-4438. You can earmark a donation for those California fires by just saying California fires, 1-888-930-4438, or find Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Dr. Kevin Voss is a regular guest. He's director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute. Thanks for joining us here.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
I'm sure you've heard this, and I think we constantly need to respond to this. People say, look, on the issues of things like abortion, embryonic stem cell research, euthanasia, none of these things are mentioned in the Bible, so no Christian really has any leg to stand on scripturally on any of those issues since they're not mentioned in the Bible. Your response?
Well, my position on that is that if they're saying that, they really don't know what the Bible says, not specifically verse by verse, you know, quoting each verse individually, but as a whole what the Bible says. The Bible is completely supportive of life, and that's really the foundation of the Bible, starting with creation and going on through redemption, creating life, redeeming life, and so it's just important for us to uphold life. In fact, the LCMS convention this summer in Houston passed a resolution on opposing embryonic stem cell research. And one of the whereases talks specifically to your question, Todd. It says, whereas the scriptures are replete with references showing that God cares for and defends the weak and the fatherless. And they cite here Deuteronomy 10:18, Psalm 68:5, Psalm 10:14, and furthermore that we are to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, Proverbs 31:8-9. And so really the whole Bible as a unit talks specifically about defending the defenseless, and that's really what God is all about, and as reflective of God's love, that's what we should be all about too.
This term defense, because people say, I am pro-life, or I am in favor of life, or they use all sorts of positive terms. And we talk about, and you often talk about, defending life. Why the defense of life? Paint the picture for us that requires Christians, especially in the public realm, to be defenders and not simply promoters of life.
Because this evil world, as it is now, with replete with sin, sin strikes to destroy life. And so I always have the image of, as we hear in the New Testament, about taking on the shield of faith. And that's really what we need to do. Speaking up for life quite often isn't enough, because really life is under attack today. It's under attack. Pope John Paul II spoke about that this is a culture of death. In his opinion, the United States was a culture of death. Many other authors have spoken about that as well. And it really is true that the devil tries to do everything he can in order to destroy life, because it's just in his interest to do so, because if he can destroy life before life has had a chance to experience the means of grace, to hear the word, and to be baptized and into the faith, that's just to his advantage. And so he just wants to destroy life, and we have to actively, as the Lord has done for us with suffering and death and resurrection of his Son, really need to defend life on as a tool of the Lord.
You know, I guess if you think of it in terms of the devil's strategy, insofar as we can discern such things, because he's awfully wily, He does seem to pick on the weak. He is a bit like that lion that doesn't go after the strongest in the herd, but always goes after the straggler, or the weakest, or the oldest, or the youngest, the easiest prey. Is that a fair picture in why we see life attacked at those stages of earliest development, or those places where life is weakest or least able to defend itself?
When you talked about that, it reminded me about the theory of evolution, survival of the fittest, so to speak. I remember the other day watching a movie in HD about a supposed dinosaur that's attacking lesser dinosaurs and taking out the weak, how that's a natural process. And what's really ironic is that we are made to feel in today's culture that destroying life is really the good thing to do, that we're upholding human rights by destroying life, particularly when we talk about abortion. We're enabling the woman to choose in order to carry out her life as she would conduct it, and therefore, by enabling her to carry out abortion, that's somehow good for society, good for her, when statistics have consistently proven just the opposite. And stem cell research, the same thing. We're taught in secular culture that destroying an embryo, weak, innocent human embryo, is good for medicine because it will help enable treatments of many incurable diseases now. So it's just ironic and really ingenious, really, in the way that the devil has twisted culture and twisted thinking to make us think just the opposite of what really normal or natural or God's created order should be.
Let's talk about that. I want to come back to abortion and euthanasia because they're very important, but the top of mind issue for many, especially our listeners back in St. Louis, has to do with embryonic stem cell research. If you may not know this, but they're facing another challenge, which would try and, quote unquote, close the loophole on so-called Amendment 2, that essentially where the voters were duped into voting for something that allows cloning and then the killing of those cloned human embryos in the state of Missouri. So do Christians oppose stem cell research?
Not necessarily, because the main thing to understand about stem cell research is there are two types of stem cell research, so-called embryonic stem cell research, which is research or stem cells derived from the destruction of human embryos at about the five-day stage, and that's why they call it embryonic stem cell research. If you believe that life begins at conception, as I do, then, of course, destroying a five-day-old human embryo in order to get the cells from that embryo is murder. But the other type of stem cell research is called adult stem cell research, or probably more appropriate, non-embryonic stem cell research. And we have stem cells in our bodies right now, in our bone marrows, in our brain. They've discovered some in our heart, in our skin. We have cells in our bodies right now that are cells from which our body derives new cells to replace the ones that are worn out. And they've also been able to get or derive some adult stem cells from a latest great discovery, I think, that could turn this whole issue upside down, in amniotic fluid. That's the fluid that surrounds babies inside of a woman's uterus. They've actually been able to extract adult stem cells or non-embryonic stem cells from that fluid. And the researchers themselves who did this experiment said that, in their opinion, that those adult stem cells are as useful and flexible as embryonic stem cells are. Of course, about a week later, they retrenched on that statement because they were placed under great pressure from the embryonic stem cell research community. But their first initial report indicated in no uncertain terms that those types of stem cells would be just as useful. So that's the main thing to understand. As Lutherans, we would be based, as we are, our ethics is based on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions, that I think we have solid biblical reasons for opposing embryonic stem cell research, but I don't believe there are really serious ethical concerns that would cause us to oppose adult stem cell research.
Okay. In theory, if there were a way to harvest stem cells from a human embryo, lay aside the issue of cloning, please, from a human embryo without destroying the human embryo, or causing any damage in the future to that human embryo, would Christians in principle have any basis for opposing that means of procuring stem cells?
If there would be a way of somehow deriving those cells without damaging an embryo or without killing the embryo, perhaps in theory we may be able to support that, but as I say, in theory. So far many experiments or several experiments have come forward or reports that have said that they've gathered embryonic stem cells from embryos without damaging the embryo. And one of the techniques, for example, is going into an 8-cell stage embryo, removing one or two of the cells from that 8-cell stage embryo, and then using those cells to make embryonic stem cells, supposedly letting the rest of the embryo intact. However, the problem with that is quite often there is damage to that embryo, and a certain percentage, at least from what I can gather, 10 to 25% of those embryos can die. Not only that, we don't know what the mutation, possible future mutations might be when we disrupt the integrity of an embryo like that. And another thing, advanced cell technology, Worcester, Massachusetts, reported success using this technique. They actually, in my opinion, committed a blatant example of research fraud in saying that they were able to derive embryonic stem cells and with leaving the embryo intact. In reality, they didn't even do that. They destroyed all of the, I believe it was 16 embryos that they worked with. They killed them all. So what they reported and what they actually did were two separate things. So perhaps in principle, but right now it just isn't. It doesn't exist.
I've been personally frustrated by this, Kevin, because it seems as though those who advocate for embryonic stem cell research in particular have been moving the goalposts on us a lot lately. They've been redefining words. We were watching the football game last night, and it would have been a great miscarriage of sporting justice, if there is such a thing, if the Packers got within 5 yards of the goal line, someone would have walked out and moved the line back another 10 yards. But that's exactly what the proponents of embryonic stem cell research are doing with words like conception, embryo. Tell us about the redefinition of words that's been taking place almost wholesale across the board on these issues.
Well, many scientists will say that embryonic stem cell research doesn't destroy early life. And the reason why they'd say that is they define the beginning of human life differently than most of us would. They would say that life really doesn't begin until the embryo is 14 days old. And before that, they would either call the embryo a pre-embryo, which used to be kind of a hot term in ethics literature maybe 10 years ago or so. Now the latest term, I think, is fertilized egg. They will call an embryo fertilized egg till 14 days of age. And then at 14 days, they will say, that's when human life begins, because implantation occurs and several other things occur at that time.
Okay, so what about the term conception? It used to mean egg and sperm meet and successfully exchange their genetic information with one another. What's the new definition according to the proponents of embryonic stem cell research?
Well, they'll say that human life is sort of a becoming. It's a process. It's not a single step that a human being sort of comes into existence with time, and that many ethicists have taken this logic really to its logical conclusion. For example, Peter Singer, a utilitarian, argues that, in his opinion, a human being isn't really a human being till they're about 2 years of age, and that really a parent or if someone has a child born of a serious developmental disability should have no ethical problem with perhaps euthanizing a baby until they're 2 years of age. And that's the argument they'll use. They'll not say that a human being has come into existence at this point. They'll say it's sort of a developmental process. The only problem is from a scientific point of view, it's ridiculous, because if you look at the science, it's clear that something magical happens at conception, something that's different from any other stage. The rest of it, when you really think about it, is just a move in position. of that embryo. It's just a change in position. It changes position from the fallopian tube, which is where the fertilization takes place, moves down to the uterus, and then from there on, it moves out into the world. It's just simply a change in position. But in my mind, it's clear that life begins at conception. And I think, personally, I think the Bible is clear on that as well. Psalm 51, verse 5 is as clear a passage as I can think of on the beginning of human life. When King David says, in sin did my mother conceive me. And the biblical term for the use of conceive there implies sinful from the time my mother became hot, which, being a veterinarian, implies when we talk about animal breeding and those sorts of things, that when do we say, especially in a farm environment, when do we say conception takes place? You know, at the time of mating. And that's, for me, it's specific that David is using that term, signifying that if he's sinful from the time my mother conceived me, then it's not a dramatic step to say, yes, we are all in existence from conception as well.
We're talking about defending life from beginning to end. Dr. Kevin Voss, director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute, is our guest. Anybody who calls or emails this hour will receive two pamphlets, one titled, What About Abortion? The other titled, What About Death and Dying? 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 30th of October. Or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. A question here from one of our pastors.
Brian O'Connor, Waukesha, Wisconsin. I've had more than one mother come to me having difficulty conceiving, has consented to having eggs harvested. Now she's being pressured by the doctor. They conceived a child, or they didn't conceive a child and they decided to give up, whatever. Now she's being pressured by the doctor. Can I have the rest of the eggs? Do I advise her pastorally, you know, one, you did a wrong thing. Two, yes, give the doctor the eggs. Three, leave them frozen for eternity. Where do I go as a pastor with the pastoral concern?
A point of clarification, are we talking about eggs that she has had harvested or embryos that have been fertilized into
embryos? It may be both. I mean, it could be either or, let's put it that way.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Voss.
Yeah, that's something you might want to inquire from her right away because it makes a big difference, in my opinion. If those, most likely they're embryos, what she's talking about, because typically what happens in in vitro fertilization is that drugs are given to the mother to what they call superovulate her in order to gather a large number of eggs to help increase the success. They'll take those eggs outside of the mother's body, which is why we call it in vitro fertilization. In vitro is simply Latin meaning in glass, versus in vivo, which means in life. That's where fertilization normally takes place. In vitro fertilization takes place outside of the mother's body, typically in a flat petri dish. So they probably took, let's say, 8, for example, eggs, and then fertilized them with some sperm from hopefully her husband, and then they perhaps put some in back into her, usually 2 to 4, and then the rest they probably froze cryogenically. And so I guess pastorally I would say, notwithstanding the whole issue of in vitro fertilization itself, but at this point in time, first of all, I would ask her if maybe she would be willing to at least allow the rest of those embryos to be put into her body to at least give a chance of conception there. If that's not agreeable with her, I would not like to see them donated to research where they're going to be destroyed. I would not like them to see them just left to die in a laboratory bench, which quite often is what fertility clinics will do. In fact, they've even discovered that some fertility clinics have been guilty of flushing them down the drain and doing egregious things like that, which is really startling. I would encourage her to donate them through an organization like Snowflake, which is a Christian organization which tries to adopt human embryos, so-called unwanted human embryos that are in a fertility clinic, embryos that are the the couple can't use for some reason or the other, or because of the result of divorce or the death of one of the two spouses. So that's what I would think would be the best way out.
Okay, then that needs a little explanation, because someone thinks embryo adoption could sound like someone saying, well, I'm going to adopt this embryo, and it's a kind of a legal procedure here, but the embryo stays in the cryogenic freeze, and I go my merry way having adopted me an embryo. The goal of Snowflake is not simply to keep the embryos safe in deep freeze, is it?
No. They actually seek potential mothers, potential families for those embryos. So those embryos aren't kept in frozen state forever.
Am I right when President Bush recently, and maybe about a year ago, talked about this publicly, about embryonic stem cell research? Did he have with him there at that press conference some children who had been brought to term and were now being raised by adoptive parents through Snowflake?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he had several there as an example of what can be done through an organization like Snowflake. And I think that's, personally, I think that was a wonderful gesture on his part to let people know that there are organizations like that. Just to fill you in, though, just because embryos are donated through Snowflake to other couples doesn't mean that every embryo is saved. Sadly, I believe, this is just off the top of my head, I think about 4,000 embryos have been donated through Snowflake. I think about 10% of them actually resulted in a living child. And the reason for that is that some of these embryos have already been kept under cryopreservation for a long period of time. They're not as viable, and so. But I still think, from an ethical point of view, that gesture of trying to echo God's concern for life through a program like that is very valuable. What's really interesting to me is that the Roman Catholic Church, I'm not sure if they've officially come out against embryo adoption, but they're very negative of embryo adoption.
And do you have any idea, with about 30 seconds here, why they might be?
The reason is their opinion on the use of in vitro fertilization as a science in and of itself. They see it as an imposition of an unnatural means and a natural act. So therefore, for them, the use of in vitro fertilization is intrinsically evil and should not be undertaken regardless.
So they don't want to be seen as encouraging in vitro fertilization, which they consider to be intrinsically evil, by encouraging the adoption of frozen embryos.
Right.
Dr. Kevin Voss is our guest, director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute. We're talking about defending life from beginning to end. When we come back, we were talking about Satan's strategies there for a moment. It seems as though he's thrown a double whammy at us with embryonic stem cell research, because not only is there the issue of the embryo and the stem cells, but also, sad to say, of human cloning as well, and we'll talk about that on the other side of this break. Anybody who calls or emails during this hour with a question or a comment will get two pamphlets called What About Abortion and What About Death and Dying. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, October the 30th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, broadcasting live from the South Wisconsin District Pastors Conference of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, issues ETC at KFUO.org. On the other side of this break, 25 more minutes with Dr. Kevin Voss. We'll also take your questions and comments from the floor if you have any of those. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issues ETC at KFUO.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, I'm Tom Baker, regular host of Law and Gospel, inviting you to tune into the program for a discussion of what benefits you receive from Jesus Christ each and every day. Law may tell you what you are supposed to do, but the gospel reveals how your failure in doing the law is fulfilled by God Himself.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Christ Memorial Lutheran Church, 5252 South Lindbergh, is proud to present Narnia, the musical, based on the C.S. Lewis classic book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Narnia, the musical, will be presented Thursday, November 8th, Friday, November 9th, and Saturday, November 10th at 7:30 p.m. There's also a Sunday, November 11th, matinee at 2 p.m. Reserved seating is $15 per person. General admission for adults is $10, $5 for children 12 and under. Narnia, the musical, at Christ Memorial Lutheran Church in South County.
science. It's only possible because of creation.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the most in-demand Bible conference speakers in North America. Ken, it's often said that evolution is an essential concept in science, but does a belief in evolution or the Big Bang really help in scientific discovery?
It is not essential to operational science at all, Mark. Think about all the amazing scientific discoveries that have happened in the last few years. We've discovered so-called living fossils like the Wollemi pine. We found dinosaur bones with soft tissue. We've even got evidence of planets orbiting other stars. But did a belief in evolution or the Big Bang help make these discoveries? Not at all. In fact, all these discoveries went against what secular scientists would expect. In reality, the reason that science is even possible is because creation is true. You see, if the universe were just an accident, and if our brains were just accidental products of evolution, why should we think that our minds would be able to understand the universe? Think about it. How could one accident be able to understand another? Science only works because the universe obeys logical mathematical formulas that we can understand. The universe is logical and orderly because it was created by a logical God who imposed order on his creation. You see, science works because the Bible's true.
Starting with the Bible, we can answer questions like whether or not there's extraterrestrial life on other planets. Read our free booklet on ETs on our website, AnswersRadio.com. The booklet's free at AnswersRadio.com.
Is Issues Etc. part of your church's mission or advertising budget for next year? Well, your congregation can now join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Membership benefits include monthly CDs, books, transcripts, and advertising your church on our website, in the Issues Etc. journal, and possibly on the radio. For more information on how your church can support this worldwide mission outreach and publicize your congregation, look for the logo of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
Here's news of a special exhibition going on now at the Missouri History Museum in Forest Park. It's titled Jamestown, Quebec, Santa Fe, Three North American Beginnings. These three settlements created a new world for both the settlers and the original inhabitants in the territory being colonized. Jamestown, Quebec, Santa Fe, Three North American Beginnings invites visitors to re-examine this important part of world history. It's all going on now at the Missouri History Museum in Forest Park. November is a month when our thoughts turn to Thanksgiving. It reminds me to say thank you to all of you who generously support the radio ministry of AM 850 KFUO with your prayers and gifts, particularly those of you who are day sponsors. If you have a special date in November, we still have some days available for day sponsorship. Call me, Chuck Rathard, at 314-505-7831, and I will personally arrange the details. 505-7831.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Reformers, not only Luther, but the other Reformers as well. We'll be talking about that with Dr. Pat Ferry tomorrow on Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Tuesday, the 30th of October. I guess that makes tomorrow Reformation Day, at least on the calendar, although most people have moved past Reformation Day. Some people call it Halloween. I don't know why. I always thought it was Reformation Day. And tomorrow we will be talking about those Reformers because it will be, by coincidence, Reformation Day. Did you plan it that way, Jeff? No. It's just we're going to be taking tomorrow off because we'll be so tired from driving back tonight. By the way, keep us in your prayers. We got to pack up and leave and go all the way back to St. Louis tonight after the show. That ought to be fun. Jeff does not make good traveling company when he's falling asleep at the wheel. And he does, I guarantee you, fall asleep at the wheel occasionally. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, issues, etc. at kfuo.org. Let's see what Kathy has to say, calling from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I know that you're talking about beginning of life issues and end of life issues, and you're talking about defending life from beginning to end. It just seems like sometimes the middle is often overlooked. I have a disabled child, as you know. I've called in before about it, and I know the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in 2004 made a resolution to facilitate ministry to people with disabilities. But if you look at the whole history of the Lutheran Church to wait until 2004, that's a long time. And then it takes a while to get things going, and then it takes a while to get people educated. And in the meantime, there are people living in the nit and grit of dealing with severely disabled people and not having help from their church body or getting some help. But people, a lot of times people don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. So, you know, people just, you know, out of education or ignorance, often nothing is done. And our family in particular has been recipient of, we now will get respite services through our county, which we live in, but it's hard to get people to come to our home. And so we can have funding for things, but it's still hard to get service from people within our own community. With, you know, it's just a problem. And I'd like you to address that issue.
Happy to do it, Kathy. Thank you very much. Let's talk about the defense of life when life is not threatened in particular, but needs that special support.
Well, that should all be a part of our concern, not just the so-called sexy issues like embryonic stem cell research, but many life issues are day-to-day experiences, involve day-to-day concerns, and especially when someone has a disabled child, that they really are people that need our help. And I know LCMS World Relief and Human Care has a component of it called the LCMS Life Ministries, and who's chaired by Maggie Carner. And I know she's concerned with a lot of those issues, and I think that our Synod, you're right, I think perhaps has been slow in recognizing the importance of these issues, but they're definitely not forgotten, and they should be emphasized more, not only in the literature they produce, literature from me perhaps, those sorts of issues are important, but also literature that our Synod puts out, and also from the pulpit. I think those sorts of things need to be talked about and not put on the back burner. And it's been my experience that pastors are hesitant to talk about life issues because they might think, well, I don't want to talk about abortion because it might split my congregation. But you don't always have to speak. Abortion is an important issue, don't get me wrong, but you can speak on a lot of other life issues that really, I think, are unifying and just a wonderful example of how we can carry out Christ's love in our community and in within our church, especially with those families that have individuals like that.
Kevin, how do you respond to someone who says, the reason I don't want my pastor talking about abortion from the pulpit is because it's a political issue?
Well, as I said before, it goes beyond a political issue. It really involves, I think, our whole outlook on life, our whole worldview. An issue like abortion, life issue, is so fundamental. And how do we see life? Do we see life as a survival of the fittest, or do we see life as something, as a wonderful part of God's plan for all of us, how God created us and how God has redeemed us and how God sanctifies us and leads us to faith? And it's just an overall worldview that's so important. So it's definitely more than just a political issue, in my opinion.
Is human cloning, at this point, still science fiction?
Human cloning so far, at least to our knowledge, hasn't been successfully done yet. But I think it's just bound to be a matter of time. There are two different types of cloning. It seems like two is kind of a magical number in bioethics, like embryonic stem cell research versus adult stem cell research. Cloning is the same way. There are two types of cloning, therapeutic, so-called therapeutic cloning, and reproductive cloning. Therapeutic cloning is the type you will see in the press all the time, the type that's called upon for us to support. And that's the type of cloning where what you do is you take an egg from a woman, empty it of its contents, of its nuclear contents, because an egg at that point has a half of the chromosomes needed to create a full individual. So you have basically a shell of an egg, and then what you do is you fuse that egg with a skin cell or a mammary cell or some other complete cell from someone's body. They actually do that through electricity, believe it or not. So it's like Frankenstein's monster that has really come to reality. And then the egg thinks, wow, I've got a full complement of DNA. I must be an embryo. So it starts dividing like a normal embryo. And in therapeutic cloning, what they would seek to do is let it to grow up to be the five-day stage, what we call the blastocyst, kill it, and remove its cells for embryonic stem cells. So that's why the issue of cloning, especially in Missouri, is tied so closely with embryonic stem cell research. That's called so-called therapeutic cloning. Notice I say so-called because no therapies have ever come from human cloning. So far, they've been unsuccessful in therapeutic cloning. They haven't been able to get any treatments from human cloning. And so that's therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning, which almost all countries in this world ethically oppose so far, thank the Lord. But in reproductive cloning, what they do is allow that embryo to grow up, put it inside a woman, just like an in vitro fertilization, and have it become a born person.
But the process of cloning, the actual cloning technique in both of those, is identical.
Yes.
It's what you do with the embryo after it is cloned. It is the only difference between those two things.
Yeah, exactly. So even though we say there are two types of cloning, and you'll see that in the press all the time, and that's sort of the way I organize it in my mind, two types of cloning. In reality, there's only one type of cloning. The process is the same, no matter what you're going to do with the embryo. And really, the only distinction between therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning is murder, essentially. When are you going to kill the embryo? And if you kill the embryo at an early stage, that's therapeutic cloning. If you allow the embryo to grow up inside of a woman, then that's reproductive cloning. And there have been several attempts to do cloning, and none of them have really succeeded to the extent that it's gotten past the 5-day cell stage. And so far, even though one researcher in Korea reported that he was able to get embryonic stem cells from a human clone, that has turned out to be another false report in the press, and so far there have been no stem cells gotten from human clones, and of course no born people from human clones as well so far.
I think it was Oregon just celebrated a rather grisly anniversary of legalized physician-assisted euthanasia. Euthanasia in itself kind of a euphemism for the doctor giving lethal doses of something to someone to kill them off. Let's talk about that. How did we get to the point where we talk about death with dignity, or what do they call it, a dignified exit, things like that, right to die? How do we get all of these euphemisms?
I think it comes, again, from the devil and the sort of worldview that he tries to impose on us, that culture of death, as John Paul II was talking about, where it's so ironic that many people would say that the caring, the sympathetic thing to do for people is to so-called allow them to die, and actually it's killing them. So how can we care for people, care for life, care for these individuals when we seek to exterminate them or allow to take their own lives? And physician-assisted suicide is the difference between that and euthanasia. By the way, the words euthanasia just simply mean good death. And again, another euphemism that's used by the movement to make us think that this is a good thing to do. But in physician-assisted suicide, what happens in that case is a physician is allowed to prescribe essentially an overdose of medication that the person, him or herself, would take to end their life. Versus in euthanasia, the physician is the active agent in actually injecting or somehow medicating that person or purposely withdrawing ventilators called passive euthanasia in order to kill that person. So either of the two, in my opinion, are ethically abhorrent. But in physician-assisted suicide, what's tough with that is that from a practical point of view, from a medical point of view, physicians have traditionally been called upon to heal, to promote life. And now all of a sudden, especially in Oregon, and many states are generating bills on their own, too. I wouldn't be surprised if the state of Wisconsin in the future would have one come up. It wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. But in that case, physicians are called upon to actually end someone's life, to withdraw their curing touch, so to speak, and to terminate them. And that's troubling not only for Christians but also for physicians, too.
How common is it? I've talked with Wesley Smith, you know who I'm talking about, from the Discovery Institute, who's been working on the issue of euthanasia and assisted suicide for probably decades in a legal capacity. And he seems to indicate that if you combine the reports that we get from kind of a legalized form of this in Oregon, along with this happening unreported elsewhere, feudal care theory in hospitals that say, hey, they're going to die anyway, let's just hasten the death. He says it's more common than people think in hospitals under the care of physicians.
I agree. I think that sort of mentality has really redefined medicine as we know it. If we were to look at medicine, let's say, in the 50s and 60s versus what we have now, one of the earliest end-of-life cases, the Karen Ann Quinlan case, which occurred in the 1970s, this was a case that involved a young woman that somehow overdosed on drugs, they think, and actually stopped breathing for a certain period of time. She was in a persistent vegetative state, and she was on a respirator and a feeding tube. And the parents, after a period of time, sought to remove their daughter from the respirator because they thought she wouldn't want to live that way, that sort of idea. And the physician in that case actually opposed removing that respirator. And I think traditionally physicians would have opposed that sort of idea. Now, it seems to me, and in the day-to-day activities at hospitals involving end-of-life people, quite often it can be the case where physicians are more open to removing, withholding, and withdrawing treatments, perhaps even too early in many cases. And I sit on a hospital ethics committee in Ozaukee County near Concordia University, and I mainly do that to have some input there, some Christian input on that committee, although most on that committee are Christians. But it amazes me how they are so pro withdrawing, withholding and withdrawing treatment if they think that a person isn't whole and has no prospect for being whole. They think that it's ethically appropriate to withhold and withdraw that treatment. And it just amazes me how open they are to that idea.
What kind of questions or comments do you have on euthanasia, abortion, embryonic stem cell research? We still have time to respond to your phone calls and to your email, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Are you talking about futile care theory? I mentioned that before, but it seems to be kind of the rave for ethics boards in hospitals and in some cases medical schools too. What is it?
Futility is sort of a technical term. Medical futility basically means that, and there are many ways it's defined, but typically a doctor would say, I ethically am not required to carry out a certain treatment on a patient if there's no likelihood of success. And the way most people define it is if in their mind that the certain treatment works in less than 1 out of 100 cases, for example. Therefore, they would not be ethically required to carry out that treatment. Futility isn't just used in end of life, too. It's used in a case like, for example, if you catch a cold, like I did this last week, and now it's gotten to the point where it's pneumonia. But if you catch a cold and you go to a doctor and you insist that doctor give you an antibiotic because your friend had the same cold and they got an antibiotic, and therefore you need an antibiotic too, where in reality colds are caused by viruses, and antibiotics typically don't work against viruses. So the doctor can at least excuse him or herself from your case, saying, sorry, in good conscience, I can't prescribe an antibiotic because it's medically futile. But sadly, this futility concept, which has been around medicine a long time, doctors are never required to do anything that they think is not in the best interest of their patients or that will have any chance of success. But it's applied to end of life in a utilitarian sense, in a greatest good for the greatest number, in that if they feel that if the patient will never turn back to full functionality, then in their concept, that's futile. And that's really not what the word futility means.
Question here from our audience.
Again, Brian O'Connor from Waukesha. Again, with the same thing, this futility thing, the hospice care that's available today, you've got a person who has had cancer a couple of times, gone through chemotherapy, says, Pastor, I'm not going to do that again. Mm-hmm. A person who's been on dialysis for a long time says, I'm done. I can't fight it anymore. could be whatever disease, but you can see where I'm going with this. Is that what you're saying? Now, again, as a pastor, do I advise that person they have to do this treatment? They have to do that?
That's a great question.
Yeah, that's a good point, because even though futility can be overused and misused at times, it's a valid concept. And I know my predecessor at the Bioethics Institute, Dr. Richard Iyer, he and I have spent several hours talking about this issue. And he pointed out something to me that was written by Dr. Gilbert Mailander, who's probably one of the most prominent bioethicists in our synod today, from Valparaiso. And if you just wanted to hang your hat on one concept, is what is the aim here? What is the aim in the treatment? Is the aim at death, or is the aim at caring? And if the aim is at caring, and a certain treatment will not help that person to an appreciable extent, is the benefit of this treatment greatly outweighed by the burdens that it places on the individual? I think from an ethical point of view, as a pastor, you could advise them to withhold. For example, why should a person go through a whole series of chemotherapy treatments perhaps to gain one or two extra days of life, you know, if they're going to die in a few days anyway? It just doesn't make sense. So thanks for that comment.
Kurt's calling from Edwardsville. Hi, Kurt. Okay, Kurt's not there. Let's see what our audience has to say.
David Groth from Good Shepherd Watertown. I ask myself, is it futile? Is it bearable? Is another question to ask, is what the cost on society? Is that appropriate to ask that question?
That's a very big question, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. And more and more in medical decisions, cost is taken into account. Not just cost decisions when it comes to the individual family or the individual involved, but quite often medical providers today are trained in bioethics and trained to appreciate the overall global perspective of some decisions that they're making. And from my point of view, from a Christian pro-life point of view, and also really from a traditional medical point of view, I'm trained as a veterinarian, not as a human doctor, but still, I think a doctor's concern should be for that patient and his or her family. And concerns for the environment or concerns for the medical healthcare organization as a whole, those sorts of concerns should be put on a back burner. And I also think that even financial considerations for the family, although they can't be completely overlooked, also need to take a back seat to deciding what's best, what is the best way we can care for this individual patient. So a very good point of view. But again, medicine is changing in that regard, and some doctors have been known to withhold and withdraw treatment from patients because they are a burden on society. Occurs in homeless people, for example, treating people without families. Quite often they will remove a treatment early because there's no insurance or because that person has no family, no one to speak up for that person.
One of the questions from the floor mentioned hospice, and I want you to talk about that, especially with respect to euthanasia, that there is an alternative. You said it's not, the aim is not death, but the aim is caring or alleviating pain or not putting someone out of their misery, but helping someone in the midst of their misery. Talk about hospice.
I think hospice is just a wonderful idea, and it's just a different alternative. I think a more God-pleasing alternative than, of course, euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. Studies have shown consistently, actually, that people who are facing terminal disease are quite often depressed. And the reason why they're seeking physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia is because they're depressed about life and depressed about their care, and they're not given enough pain medications if they have cancer, for example. And so all of these issues kind of play on their minds as to what's the best way out of a situation. But hospice is a way of caring for someone holistically, for providing them with the appropriate levels of health care, pain medication, eating properly, just showing them that people care. And it's such a wonderful thing. In my own experience, my mother-in-law, who died from cancer, was greatly benefited by hospice.
Someone's going to say, look, I've watched the hospice, and I've been in there with the nurses and the doctors who help, and they were giving Grandma amounts of morphine, and they told us if we would have given this to a normal person without her condition, it would kill them. Is the morphine killing Grandma while it's alleviating her pain? That's a big question we often get about hospice and pain control.
That could quite often be true. Someone who's in a lot of pain will tolerate a lot more pain medications. However, again, studies have shown that people who are in pain or someone, of course, at the end of life will not become addicted to these medications, and that was the kind of the great issue of a lot of physicians. They hesitated to prescribe high enough degrees of morphine to take away pain from a terminal cancer patient because they were afraid that person would become addicted. Well, that's clearly crazy when you think about they're going to be dying in a few weeks or a few months. But pain medication, yes, may perhaps advance the death of someone, and death may come a little bit earlier, possibly. But here again, I think an important question to ask is, what is the aim? What is your aim here, to care, or is it to take this one's life?
Finally, we've talked a lot about the culture of death. With about 30 seconds here, just paint a picture for us of a culture of life. What should it look like? 30 seconds.
Well, culture of life, and we'll of course never see it in this earth, sadly, but culture of life is, if everything were ideal in this culture of life, it would be people brought into being without the burdens of the threat of abortion, allowing them to grow up and in the gospel, to hear the gospel, to be baptized into the church, to experience not just life on this earth, but life, eternal life in heaven. That would be my ideal vision of life.
Dr. Kevin Voss is director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute. Thank you very much for being our guest. I hope you feel better.
Yeah.
You can find out more about the Concordia Bioethics Institute. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click links, and you'll find a direct link to Dr. Kevin Voss and the Concordia Bioethics Institute. A special thanks to Matt Sander for all the help he's provided, and for the scotch last night. That was pretty nice, too. Pastor Larry Myers, who without his help, and I don't see where he's at anymore, we would not be here. Thank you very much to all the pastors and the people in the South Wisconsin District, and to President John Willey for the invitation and for the hospitality during this time with you. Thanks to our audience. Give yourself a round of applause for your help and your participation. All the questions that you asked. Did we finally give away all the mugs? We have to take any back with us? Tomorrow on the program, the Lutheran Reformers versus the other Reformers. Dr. Pat Ferry, president of Concordia University, will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.